Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives today, as usual. And, Jim, we talked last week about how the hits just keep on coming for Hillary Clinton and her really rough rollout of her campaign last week and all her inaccuracies, deliberate and unnecessary errors throughout the campaign. But now she's about to get hit with another shot. This one, a book by Peter Schweizer, a guy who I believe is fairly conservative, but he made his biggest splash in the publishing world with a book a couple of years ago, hitting both Republicans and Democrats, taking advantage essentially of insider trading in order to protect their money prior to the 2008 financial collapse. And he shamed a couple of them into retirement, including a very powerful Republican from Alabama. But his new book is called Clinton Cash, The Untold Story of How and Why Foreign Governments and Businesses Helped Make Bill and Hillary Rich. It's a 186-page book. In the New York Times, Mr. Schweizer is quoted as saying, "We will see a pattern of financial transactions involving the Clintons that occurred contemporaneous with favorable U.S. policy decisions benefiting those providing the funds." This, of course, during Hillary's time as Secretary of State. The Times reports his examples include a free trade agreement in Colombia that benefited a major foundation donor's natural resource investments in the South American nation, development projects in the aftermath of the Haitian earthquake in 2010, and more than $1 million in payments to Mr. Clinton by a Canadian bank and major shareholder in the Keystone XL oil pipeline around the time the project was being debated in the State Department. And, oh, by the way, Bill Clinton has publicly endorsed Keystone, despite the fact that the president is obviously against it. So, obviously, Schweizer will be painted as a partisan right-wing hack by the Clinton people, but when there's already these rumors out here, this book couldn't come at a better time, Jim.
There's a lot to feel cheery about if you're not a fan of Hillary Clinton about this. Because, look, one, as they said, the style of the book is not overwrought, frothing at the mouth, innuendo stuff. Apparently, it is his best attempt to do straight journalism and lay out the facts. And the facts appear to be pretty devastating. And it draws together a couple of things that have kind of nagged at us and other, you know, folks have written about. It's interesting that he said that he's given exclusives to the New York Times and to Fox News and to various other journalistic institutions to kind of let them look at the same stories. And some of these stories it feels like we've heard about before, looking at the Clinton Foundation's donations from foreign governments and things like that. There are a couple of things people on the right or people who don't like the Clintons have been pointing out for a couple of years now. The unbelievably large speaking fees that Bill and Hillary get, the number of people who she speaks to or has connections to who she had some sort of decision-making authority over at the State Department while she was at the State Department. Obviously, the number of foreign countries would be really fascinated in getting in and having a buying friendship, so to speak, with a future president of the United States. The just general money-grubbing atmosphere that's around the Clintons, even though they are more than comfortable and more than wealthy and no discernible need for the money. Here they are. This you know, connects all the dots and basically say, look, this is a favor factory. People making that accusation against the Clinton Foundation for a couple of years now. And it now sounds like he very much connects the dots. Now, would this be provable in a court of law? We'll see if anything comes out of it. I think it's safe to say there's not a single prosecutor in the country who would want to take on Hillary Clinton without some sense of fear or some sense of intimidation. But if this is laid out, then Hillary Clinton has been effectively, you know, been bribed for years and years now. He says that the highest paid speeches of Bill Clinton's entire career all came when she was Secretary of State. That's kind of an interesting little indicator there that he became a lot more valuable as a speaker when his wife was making decisions at the State Department. Boy, you know, now again, she'd probably be able to say, look, this is all coincidental. Everything was on the up and up. I did nothing in corruption. Everything was, you know, everyone had the best of intentions. And my emails will prove it, Greg. Oh, wait, they're all deleted now. Oh, gee, that almost, I'm sure they would have been so exculpatory, but unfortunately they're all deleted. Huh? Boy, that's a bummer, huh?
Yeah. We'll just never know. But just got to take our word for it. She's been on the up and up with us over the years. So,
of course. Yeah, it's not like she's lied in the past. So.
Right. All right. Speaking of the foreign policy of the Obama administration, both during and after Hillary Clinton's tenure in the State Department, our bad martini is once again very, very bad. And it comes to us from the Middle East. Last week was full of troubling news. ISIS closing in on surrounding Ramadi, Al-Qaeda essentially taking over a key airport and various other critical points in Yemen. Now we get a double shot over the weekend. This one from Breitbart. The Islamic State has released a new video showing terrorists beheading 15 men on the beaches of Libya's Barka province and 15 other men in the desert in the southern Fazan province. The terrorist group claimed the men were worshippers of the cross belonging to the hostile Ethiopian church. It's a 30-minute video, 30 people beheaded, and it's essentially an ongoing screed against Christianity and Catholicism in particular. At the same time, we got this horrific story over the weekend of about 900 people dead on a migrant ship that was obviously way overloaded, trying to desperately flee Libya, trying to get to Italy. It capsized in the middle of the night of about 950 people on board. Over 900 are dead, and obviously they're trying to flee the carnage that is in Libya. We have a hand in what's going on there right now and the lack of stability, Jim. So overall, things obviously not getting better.
Two lessons here. The first is another mass beheading by ISIS, and it's not that big a story. I haven't seen, you know, wall-to-wall coverage of it, and obviously none of these are Americans, but nonetheless, you know, ISIS continues to commit horrific, barbaric crimes and acts of terrorism, and life in America just operates as normal. It's not a big deal to our administration, so why would it be a big deal to the American people? And then the second aspect is we have this mentality of, well, it's far away, it's not going to bother us, it's not going to be our problem. We periodically seem to have those hard lessons that, no, the world's problems very rarely stop at our borders. If you're Europe right now, you have to be looking at this and saying, hey, having chaos and instability and Islamist groups running around being maniacal and killing people in places like Libya and Tunisia and North Africa and places like that, look, you're just going to see more and more people trying to make that journey across the Mediterranean, and they're seeing one sea disaster after another. And so, like, the U.S. and Europe and NATO, they can't solve all the world's problems, but you're just, how bad does a problem have to get before somebody tries to do something about it? We will see. I think, you know, that this is an administration that likes to ignore foreign policy problems and hope that they'll go away, and I don't see any reason to think it's going to be any different in its approach until January 2017.
I think there actually was a statement yesterday, a written statement from the administration, but it's obvious based on the brutality and the carnage that we've seen in past few weeks, that there's less and less of a public response here. And I don't know that that means they just don't care as much as we'd like them to care, or whether it's becoming so commonplace that they feel they don't need to express as much as before. Either way, it's a disturbing trend, to say the least. But on to the crazy martini now. And perhaps one of the reasons why 30 people being beheaded and 900 people drowning in the Mediterranean aren't getting as much attention as they should is because, Jim, we are just, you know, 18 and a half months away from a presidential election.
And that's the preeminent story, says the guy who covers 2016.
So. Exactly. So there was essentially a New Hampshire Republican Party cattle call up there this weekend. By some reports, 20 active or potential Republican candidates were up there trying to test the waters. Up in the Granite State, you obviously had the ones who are officially in the race, the three senators, and plenty of others who are likely to get in fairly soon. There's two, though, that are really serious about getting in here, Jim, that we've laughed about in the crazy martini in the past, but apparently they're not laughing with us. One is former New York Governor George Pataki, who is obviously going to be from the more moderate side of the party, and it's hard to see where he's got any oxygen there, especially given that his ratings when he left the office weren't that spectacular. Then there's Lindsey Graham, who's not exactly the favorite of conservatives on a variety of issues, especially immigration, but some others as well. And he is now saying he's 91% sure that he is going to run. George Pataki says, bet on him to run if he had to make the decision today. Jim, why are these people bothering?
That's a really good question. I'm going through it, and Lindsey Graham, there are a bunch of reasons that he's not going to go anywhere, right? I mean, there are conservatives who don't like him. As much as I think he's a personally nice enough guy, I don't think you'd necessarily say that he was a amazing public speaker or some sort of defiant voice of the party. I think people like what he's done on the Judiciary Committee. But he also has voted for a couple Obama Supreme Court justices, right? I mean, he's a guy who will make the great case against Sonia Sotomayor and then turn around and confirm her, which is, you know, kind of maddening from a lot of perspectives. I'd also point out, say, Greg, what's probably the third most important state in the presidential selection process?
Probably South Carolina.
Probably South Carolina. So if he runs, presumably he gets a decent chunk of his home state vote. And then all of a sudden, every other Republican candidate might say, why compete so much in South Carolina? It's going to vote for Lindsey Graham anyway. By the way, it may not. But, you know, yes. I'm sure there are a lot of South Carolina Republicans who are like, no, Lindsey, don't do that. don't have the Tom Harkin effect. Don't, you know, dissuade everybody from coming to our state and competing because you're running here. So, yeah, that's baffling. And then Pataki, I mean, you know, a guy who probably the highlight of his career was that address right before George W. Bush at the 2004 convention. Would we take him over Andrew Cuomo? Sure. You know, that's not a high bar to clear. Is he walking around and he says, everywhere I go in this country, people want me to run for president. Are they members of his family? Or are they just people who just want him to leave where they are right now? Man, this conversation. You know, George, yeah, Pataki, you really should go run. I mean, like, run away from me right now. Just run for president. And, you know, awkward cocktail party conversations that driven. They are the coal that burn, that fuels the engine of Pataki 2016. I don't know what the heck this is all about. Both of these guys, like, you don't want to be the authority who says you can't run for president, but it certainly seems like it's been a full field as is, and just kind of this nagging sense of you know, wondering what they really feel that they have to add to the debate different from everybody else, other than satisfying their own egos.
Is Lindsey Graham just getting in to troll Rand Paul?
And maybe that's entirely possible.
And maybe I
figured Bolton would have that role. I am here just to renounce what I see as the isolationism. The other theory I remember, you know, wondering about with Bolton, and you know, the guy's always been very nice to me. I don't mean this to be seen as a criticism, but it's not inconceivable that you could have a George W. Bush type ending up being, you know, getting the Republican nominee. Somebody who's been a governor who is not enormously experienced in the realm of foreign policy. Scott Walker could fit the bill. Maybe you might say somebody like John Kasich, insert any governor who hasn't done a lot in the foreign policy realm who would want a VP who has a lot of experience in the realm of foreign policy. And certainly that is what you think of when you think of John Bolton. Whatever his career path goes, I think the Secretary of State in the next administration seems like the most natural fit and the most natural spot for him. But, you know, that's up to John Bolton, and he's got to make his own decisions that way. So we'll see how it shakes out. But some of these guys, Rob Portman, for example, the senator from Ohio, seemed like a perfectly decent guy who nobody was clamoring to run for president, and he made the choice not to run. And good for you, Senator Portman, and I hope you win re-election by a wide margin.
Remember in 2012 where the polls were jockeying all over the place, and whoever was at 1% was way on the edge, and then every time they had their little surge, like Herman Cain, they'd suddenly be in the middle in the next debate, and then as the things got worse for them, they'd be out on the fringes again. Can you just imagine how far out George Pataki and Lindsey Graham will be if we get like 10 or 12 people in this race?
Well, the other observation is that, you know, you have these guys, and more than one candidate or their staff has said some version of this to me, which is that, look, you know, a lot of people say we have no chance. We're at 1%, 2%, 5%, you know, so we're way behind. But by golly, in 2012, everybody got 1 month to be frontrunner. Michelle Bachmann was frontrunner for about a month. Herman Cain was frontrunner for about a month. So by golly, you know, our guy's going to get that opportunity. And when he does, he's going to make the most of it. And there are certain folks who are polling not so well right now who you could see seizing that moment. And then there's some where you're like, you got to be kidding me. You know, you're at 1% for a reason. And I think they're all, you know, utterly convinced that they're going to get their moment on the national stage. And all of a sudden, everything's going to change.
Well, we'll keep watching. We'll keep counting them up. Have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to join us again on Tuesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.